Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff, read by Gretchen Miller, featuring Smitten Kitchen. We're going to start off today with the summer steak with corn and tomatoes. This has been my go-to summer steak for the last several years, and I have some audacity to have kept it for so long. Mostly, we've been too busy eating it for me to grab the camera and shoot it and then sit down and write the recipe, which is hilarious, as that's like my whole job. But my brain softens in the summer, especially when my kids are away at sleepaway camp, as they are now, and we quickly lose whatever tethers we had to things like to-do lists, responsibilities, and adulting. And while I do not expect a skirt steak with a cherry tomato and sweet corn salad to shake the cooking internet off its axis, there are a bunch of tips tucked into this recipe that make it a reliable favorite, and I hope to become part of your repertoire too. The steak rub has some brown sugar in it. There's enough salt that it's still savory, not sweet, but I absolutely love the way it improves caramelization at the edges. I don't make or eat a ton of steak, but when I do, I obsessively, yes, obsessively, need it to be both black at the edges and pink inside. And the thinner the steak, the harder this is to pull off. But skirt steak is so delicious when done right and feels like it stretches further for a crowd. I can't resist it here. Two other things help achieve this: a ripping hot grill or pan, one that can impart color on each side in 2 minutes, and keeping the steak in the fridge until you cook it. I find that if the center arrives on the heat cold, it builds in a better margin of error before it overcooks. My next favorite part of this recipe is that when we give the corn a chance to marinate and even gently pickle, dropping it warm from the grill into the vinaigrette and letting it hang out. It contrasts deliciously with the sweet cherry tomatoes and a fistful of herbs. This is easily scaled up for more people, and the salad keeps well, so you shouldn't feel rushed. My perfect summer spread with this would include this herbed summer squash and potato tort, and there's a recipe at smittenkitchen.com, the obsessively good cucumber and avocado salad, and then definitely some cheesecake bars with all the berries. Again, those recipes are at smittenkitchen.com. But if it's just you, I like the way the steak salad combination always feels like a full meal. So here's summer steak with corn and tomatoes. Serves 3 to 4, takes 40 minutes, and the source is Smitten Kitchen. For the steak, you'll need 1¼ to 1½ pound of skirt steak, 2 tablespoons of brown sugar, 1 tablespoon of kosher salt, 1 teaspoon of sweet or hot smoked paprika, freshly ground black pepper, salad. You're going to need 2 ears of fresh corn, 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 4 tablespoons of apple cider vinegar, 1 teaspoon of kosher salt, freshly ground black pepper, 1 clove of garlic, minced, 4 scallions, thinly sliced, white and green, 2 cups of cherry tomatoes, halved or quartered, 1 jalapeno, seeds removed, finely chopped, and 1 cup of finely chopped fresh herbs such as parsley, mint, basil, chives, or a mix thereof. You're going to prep the steak by patting the steak dry and placing it on a plate or tray. If your grill or pan for cooking is smaller than the length of it, then cut the steak into segments that will fit. Combine the sugar, salt, paprika, and many grinds of black pepper in a small bowl, and then sprinkle half of it over the top of the steak. Flip the steak over and repeat on the second side. Transfer to the fridge and let chill for 30 minutes or up to a few hours until you're ready to grill. I do this uncovered to encourage the edges to dry out, which is just my preference. Loosely covered works too. Next, you're going to make the corn and tomato salad. Cook the corn your favorite way. I use the grill, and then heat your grill to a high heat. Shuck the cobs and remove any stringy bits and lightly oil the cobs. You're going to place directly on the grill and cook until charred spots form, rotating the cobs as needed. This can take about 5 to 10 minutes, depending on how robust your grill is. Set the cobs aside to cool slightly while you make the dressing. Pour the olive oil, cider vinegar, kosher salt, and many grinds of black pepper in a medium-large bowl and whisk to combine. When the corn is cool enough to handle, with a towel if needed, cut the kernels from the cob and add to the dressing in the bowl. Scatter the tomatoes, jalapeno, scallions, and herbs on top of the corn in layers, but I don't bother mixing it at this point. I like the corn to marinate and gently pickle in the dressing while I cook the steak. As far as doing ahead, the corn salad can be made 1 hour in advance. If you'd like to make it even earlier, I'd leave the herbs off until right before serving so that they don't discolor. Next, you're going to cook the steak on a grill. You're going to heat your grill to high for 10 minutes before using it. I like my small gas grill as ripping hot as I can get it for skirt steak, since it's so thin and I want to get color on the outside before it overcooks in the center. You're going to lightly oil the grill and the steak, cooking for 2 minutes on the first side and then flipping it and cooking it for 2 minutes on the second side for medium rare. Transfer to a cutting board to rest for 5 to 7 minutes. On the stove, you're going to heat your heaviest skillet, ideally cast iron, over high heat for several minutes until the pan is smoking hot. And then you're going to lightly coat it with a neutral oil and add the steak. If you had to cut yours into a few segments, you might only be able to cook two at a time. And you're going to cook for 2 minutes on the first side, then flip the steak and cook it for 2 minutes on the second side for a medium rare steak. Transfer to a cutting board to rest for 5 to 7 minutes. Then you assemble and serve. Stir the tomato corn salad to mix the ingredients and taste, adjusting the seasoning if needed. Once the steak has rested, cut it across the grain into 1/4 to 1/2 inch thick slices and arrange the steak fanned on a serving platter and drizzle any juices that have collected on the cutting board over it. Season lightly with additional salt and pepper, and then spoon some tomato corn salad over it, leaving the rest in a bowl on the side for adding more at the table, and eat right away. Our next recipe is going to be for some apple and cheddar scones. That sounds awesome. This is pretty much October on a parchment-lined baking sheet. They want to be packed in a basket so they can go apple picking with you and to sneak in the car to join you for a leaf peeping drive. They want to come to brunch with you and deserve to be served with warm apple cider, whether getting lost in a corn maze or searching for the best pumpkin to carve. So, have we spoken this week? If we have, I've probably gone on and on about them, about how I never really was into that whole apple cheddar thing, but these change things. They are absolutely fantastic. They're from The Perfect Finish, which is a dessert cookbook by Bill Yosses, who is now the executive pastry chef at the White House, but not when he wrote this, and Melissa Clark, who I suspect you're already quite fond of. When I first saw the recipe, I rejected it as fussy for making you roast apples in 1/16 just to let a stand mixer bang them up. I snorted over how chefs always like to boast that their recipes are fairly simple for home cooks, but then they use weights measured to the 1/100th of an ounce, fooling nobody. And then I made them, and I shut up, because these are blissful. Just a little sweet with a shaggy sugared lid, a not too intensely cheddar background with random chunks of baked apples throughout. All that in a scone. Oof. I'm obsessed and about to make my third batch because I don't think I'll be able to go anywhere this weekend without some fresh from the oven. Suddenly it wouldn't be October without them. And so didn't say I didn't warn you. Here are the recipe for apple and cheddar scones, or scones, depending on how you like to pronounce it. This is barely tweaked from The Perfect Finish. This makes 6 generous scones. You're going to need 2 firm tart apples. It'll be around 1 pound, 1.5 cups of all-purpose flour, 1/4 cup sugar, plus 1.5 tablespoons for sprinkling, 1/2 tablespoon of baking powder, 1/2 teaspoon of salt plus additional for egg wash, 6 tablespoons of unsalted butter chilled and cut into 1/2 inch cubes plus additional for the baking sheet if not lining it with parchment, 1/2 cup of sharp cheddar shredded, white is recommended, I assume, for aesthetics, and 1/4 cup of heavy cream and 2 large eggs. You're going to position a rack at the center of the oven and preheat it to 375 degrees Fahrenheit. You're going to line a baking sheet with parchment paper. Peel and core the apples and then cut them into 1/16. I assume this meant chunks, not slivers. Place them in a single layer on a baking sheet lined with parchment paper and bake them until they take on a little color and feel dry to the touch, about 20 minutes. They will be about half baked. You're going to let them cool completely, and you can speed this up in the fridge as I did, and then leave your oven on. You're going to sift or whisk the flour, sugar, baking powder, and salt together and set aside. Place the butter in the bowl of an electric mixer with a paddle attachment, along with cooled apple chunks, cheese, cream, and 1 egg. Sprinkle the flour mixture over the top and mix on low speed until the dough just comes together. Do not overmix. If you don't have a stand or a hand mixer, I'd rub the cold butter into the flour mixture with my fingertips or with a pastry blender and hand chop the apples coarsely and mix the rest together with a wooden spoon until combined. It might feel awkward, but it should all come together. Again, don't overmix it though. It'll be harder to do this by hand. Generously flour your countertop and place the scone dough on top of it. Sprinkle it with flour, and then using a rolling pin to gently roll, or use your hands to pat, the dough into 1 1/4 inch thick 6-inch circle. Cut the circle into 6 wedges. Transfer them to a baking sheet that has either been buttered or lined with a fresh sheet of parchment paper, and leave at least 2 inches between each scone. Beat the remaining egg in a small bowl with a pinch of salt. Brush the scones with egg wash and sprinkle them with the remaining tablespoon of sugar. Bake until firm and golden, about 30 minutes. With a spatula, you're going to lift them to a wire rack to cool for 10 minutes. And before you eat one, make sure that you realize how addictive they might be. Once you've got that down, go for it anyway. As far as doing ahead, scones are best the day they're baked. However, they can be made ahead of time and stored unbaked in the freezer until you need them. Simply brush them with the egg wash and sprinkle them with sugar and bake them still frozen for just a couple of extra minutes. This way, they're always freshly baked when you want them. These scones were passable on day 2 and terrible on day 3. I don't think that's going to happen. Next, we're going to have a recipe for rum Campari punch. If I were to sum up this year, which I won't because I'm long-winded enough when I describe a single day, it's terrifying to consider what I would do with 365 of them. But after I got past all of the good stuff, and really it's been a spectacular year, what with 2 book tours and several vacations and lots of awesome family time and dinner parties and, oh, see, there I go. I'd admit that at least from the vantage point of trying to relocate recipe ideas from my head to the kitchen, to this computer, and then onto yours, I've somewhat flopped, and I have the photo IOUs to prove it. Would you like a tour? For example, I've been meaning to tell you about blistered green beans ever since my cookbook went to print, and I realized I had completely forgot to include this as a recipe. It was meant to go as a quick side to the flat roasted chicken. I'm sorry. I've tried more times than I'd like to admit to insert gorgeous orange segments into baked goods, only to repeatedly conclude that I just don't like baked orange segments. I created 5 egg salads recipes for a magazine that never ran in 2012, and I've been meaning to tell you about them here instead. Maybe in 2014? This was obviously written a while ago. I've been meaning to update the herb summer squash and potato tort with fresh photos forever because we make it all summer. And I owe you some whole wheat yogurt cherry and chocolate chunk. Fine, I'll say it. Cherry Garcia scones. It's probably best that we never talked about that time that I made pickle brine and pretzel crusted chicken tenders. P.S. Not sorry. Had I not used the grossest store-bought vegetable stock ever, that which imparts an orange hue to everything, we would have talked about this parsnip soup with a dreamy Brussels apple bacon hash months ago. Now, sweet carroty baby food is all I can remember about it. I'd wanted to tell you about my lazy meatballs, but I accidentally made them even lazier by forgetting the egg. I'm still on the fence as to whether this was a bad thing. I tried and tried to make a pear brown butter gluten-free C-L-A-F-O-T-I-S. My French is not very good, but gluten-free clafouti. But I've never got it the way that I wanted it. I've been trying to get the big apple puffy pancake the way I want it for several apple seasons now, but something is just never quite right. I can't believe we've never discussed my favorite fall-winter drink, the perfect Manhattan. And I made a butternut squash and kale pesto pizza. It was kind of weird. Have you ever had Frico potatoes? Well, if you have, you'll know that this photo with the overhead light makes a glistening horror of things. It's a blessing in disguise, as it will keep people from knowing how dangerously delicious it is. I've been meaning to do a separate post on my favorite vegetable roasting method. And I still get sad when I remember the acres of perfect tiny strawberries that my mother and I picked in June so I could make jam that never set. Though my strawberries and syrup, as we called it instead, is so dreamy on cheese blintzes, I've almost forgiven it. You're going to be mad when you find out that I made this cake and kept it from you. I promise to make it right when we're all back to eating sugar and carbs again in February, okay? I realized I'm the kind of mother who does things like this for lunch boxes. This probably only surprised me, and she's got a photo of beautiful, beautifully round watermelon balls. We still make and eat a lot of broccoli slaw, and I created a quick stovetop pasta, cheese, and vegetables for a magazine. Since I wasn't enlisted to photograph it, I tested it with whatever I had around. Wheels and cheese may be where it's at, people. She used wheel-shaped pasta. It looks really cute. I owe you some towering peach muffins, but first I owe them to myself, because in 6 tries this summer, I never got them right. I owe you some Concord grape lemonade, whole wheat grissini, and kale pecorino popcorn from when it was our week to bring snacks to school. I owe you an eggplant parmesan, Tien. Some multigrain Parker House rolls, a goat cheese souffle, pecan pumpkin arugula, and a recipe for that rhubarb meringue tart that fell on the floor before we could eat it. And there's pictures of all these beautiful recipes that Deb's talking about. And since we're being honest, sometimes I thought about writing another cookbook, but then pretty much without fail, I came back to my senses. I was kind of bummed when I realized there were so many things that we didn't get to see this year, and decided that I'll make the last item on my December wish list, a holiday rum punch, happen like no matter what. So trust me, this was no hardship to undertake. Can we talk about rum punch for a minute? If you're like me, you probably just assumed that rum punch equals fruit juice and rum. You may have not known that Bachan, which is Barbadian rum punch, and Planter's Punch, the two best known rum punches, date back over a century and even have their own rhyme. One of sour, two of sweet, three of strong, four of weak. I like to imagine that no matter how many you've had, you won't forget how to make more. However, how you define these elements needs only to be limited by your imagination. While the sour element is usually lime juice, it may also be lemon or another citrus juice. And I imagine that both pomegranate and cranberry juices would mix in well. The sweet part is usually a simple syrup, a 1-to-1 mixture of sugar and water, heated until it dissolves and is cooled. The strong should be good island rum, preferably dark, and the weak can be water or club soda. Sometimes it's ice and sometimes it's more juice, like pineapple. In my opinion, rum punch made with pineapple juice is always 200% better than those made without it. Rum punch can either be mixed in a shaker with ice, a dash or two of Angostura bitters, and a pinch of nutmeg, though I've seen versions with everything from cayenne to grenadine and vermouth in them. Or it can be served in a big punch bowl with a ladle. While I was bent on coming up with my own spin on rum punch for you, Tasting Table rendered this completely unnecessary last week, sharing a recipe from Brad Ferran, formerly of Brooklyn's Clover Club, and now head bartender at Garland in Raleigh, North Carolina, with a curious addition of the bitter, red, and citrusy aperitif known as Campari, which is the primary ingredient in Negronis. And we just had to make it. This is not your ordinary rum punch. The intensity of the Campari is surprising at first, but quickly becomes the best part of it. And I can't think of a better excuse to bring down the vintage punch bowl down from the top shelf in your parents' house as I did last night, though sadly after I'd already taken these photos. I think punch is overdue for a comeback. It's pretty. It doesn't demand that every single ingredient is top shelf. It's forgiving of any adjustments you need to make, and it serves a crowd. And if you want to get a head start and make it today, you'll find that it gets admirably even mellower and more harmonious with age, even if you, understandably, do not intend to. So here's the recipe, Rum Campari Punch, adapted from Brendan McHale, Tasting Table Test Kitchen. Don't fret if you don't have a punch bowl. Any big bowl and a soup ladle plus small cups will do. Icing down the punch bowl or chilling it before you use it will help keep the drinks cooler longer. You can make a dramatic ice boulder for the center by freezing a Tupperware-like container full of water the night before. Ever the New Yorkers, we used a takeout container. Brad Ferran of Garland in Raleigh, North Carolina, smartly noted to TT that the lid will keep you from spilling water as you move it into the freezer. I should have listened. Finally, one of the things about punch is that it ages well. A day or two later, the flavors are more mellow and harmonious. We made this over the weekend for practice, okay? And can't wait to bring it to our New Year's Eve party. You know, all 2 hours that we are there before going home to put this little dude to bed. But just put the fizzy stuff in when you're ready to serve it so it doesn't get flat. The adjusted recipe below is a little sweeter than the original and uses slightly less rum, as 3 3/4 cups are called for, but that would require you had a full bottle plus a half cup from another, and it was plenty strong even with a missing rum. Cruisin Blackstrap rum was recommended, but we were unable to find it, a bummer, as it is dark black in color and would have made this thing all the more stunning. And updated to the note, it's based on some of your responses, the Cruisin Blackstrap rum was not the dream many of us hoped it would be, so many found it to yield a dark or less pretty murky color punch with a strong molasses flavor. So if this sounds appealing, definitely seek out this rum, but if not, just use a regular dark rum as we did. Hope that helps. So the yield is just shy of 4 quarts. You can ladle 30 1/2 cup servings from it. For the punch, you'll need 1 1/2 cups sugar, 1 1/4 cups, excuse me, let's back up. For the punch, 1 1/4 cups sugar, 1 1/4 cups cold water, 1 1/4 cups of lime juice, 3 3/4 cups of pineapple juice, 1 3/4 cup of Campari, for or less, to taste, 1 750 milliliter, which is about 3 1/2 cups of a bottle of dark rum, and 1 750 milliliter bottle of sparkling wine. For garnish, you'll need 1 giant ice cube, 1 orange, sliced thin, 1 lime, sliced thin, or thick peels of zest from 1 lime and 1 orange. You're gonna heat the sugar with 1/4 cup cold water until it comes to a boil and the sugar dissolves. Pour in the remaining cold water and let cool before using. This is your simple syrup. Mix the cooled simple syrup with lime juice, pineapple juice, Campari, and rum in a chilled bowl or chill in the fridge until ready to serve. To serve, add sparkling wine, a large ice cube, and citrus garnishes. Serve with a ladle into small cups. Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff, read by Gretchen Miller.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.